The way one describes a story to oneself or the world is by telling the story. It is a balancing act, and it is a dream. The more accurate the map, the more it resembles the territory. The tale is the map that is the territory. You're listening to Western Worlds. Hello, and welcome back for another conversation here on Western Worlds, an AFM original show heard right here on astronomy.fm. My name is Dr. John, and I'm coming to you this week, as every week, from the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration at Western University, located just 2,063 kilometers from the Kennedy Space Center in beautiful London, Ontario, Canada. Tonight's opening quote comes courtesy of the British science fiction author Neil Gaiman and echoes the dictum of Alfred Korzybski that the map is not the territory. It is an important truth to understand that reality may be different from a schematic that you hold in your hands, but at the same time, we need to recognize that the broad strokes of the story of distant lands and our relationship to them are right there on the page. That is especially true of places so distant that we know them mainly through our surrogates of telescopes and of spacecraft. For instance, even the history of science is written in the sky for all to see. The constellations come from the Greeks. The familiar names of the planets are written in Latin, the language of the conquering Romans. And what of the brighter stars, such as Altair, Rigel, or Vega? Their Arabic names preserve the history of the Middle Ages when scientific knowledge was maintained and developed in North Africa and in the Middle East. Closer to home, Valles Marineris on Mars, literally Mariner Valley, will ensure that the first extensive observer of that planet, Mariner 9, is not soon forgotten. So, our maps of other worlds also record little pieces of ourselves, our culture, our times in which we live, and our technology. It is a bit of a complex relationship, and for evidence of that, you need look no further than the anthropomorphic title of tonight's music, Theme from Bitter Moon by Vangelis. But there is also a deeper level. The maps we make of the planets unite multiple observations to give us a deeper understanding of the processes that shaped the worlds that we study. Thus, we begin to piece together the story of the world itself, the creation of that territory, its present state, and its future, all through our map-making. Tonight's guest, a cartographer par excellence, has spent his professional career telling that story. Philip Stuck is an associate professor in the Department of Geography at Western University. He sat down recently with our own Alyssa Gilbert to talk about his experiences in planetary mapping from the astronauts of the Apollo era to today's golden age of robotic exploration in our solar system.
So I guess we'll start off just in a general sense, just in case our listeners aren't aware of what's going on in planetary exploration right now. Can you give us kind of a general overview of the missions that are out there and what they're doing?
Well, what isn't going on in planetary science these days? This is an amazing time. We have spacecraft, you know, almost all over the solar system. So it really is quite a fantastic time to be interested in this subject. We've got spacecraft orbiting Mercury and Venus and the Moon and Mars, and another one orbiting an asteroid, and another one orbiting Saturn, and another one on its way to Jupiter, another one on its way to Pluto, another one on its way to a comet, and so on. So there are lots of things happening and other things coming up in the future. Every day I check on the web, I check the latest picture that's been released from Mercury or from the asteroid Vesta or from Mars. You know, there's always something to see. So it's a great time. There are things all over the place.
When you look at these images, are you looking for anything in particular or just interesting things?
Well, no, I wouldn't say I'm looking for something particular. Most of the time, anyway. Really, it's just a matter of kind of trying to keep up with all the things that are happening, because people are always asking me. So I have to kind of know what's going on. But, you know, as an example, for instance, the Messenger spacecraft is orbiting Mercury. It takes pictures of Mercury and sends them back every day. And every day there's a sort of a press release picture put out on the website. Well, I want to see what those pictures are every day. And they've been photographing a lot of interesting little volcanic features on the surface, kind of keeping track of these discoveries. Recently, they had a picture of what looked like channels cut across the surface by flowing lava. So, you know, I want to kind of keep up with these things and then, you know, kind of repeat that all the way around the solar system. So Cassini's orbiting Saturn. Every time it makes looping orbit of the planet, at the closest point to the planet, it's taking pictures of a bunch of moons and so on. And so I check in the latest pictures from the moons all the time there to see what's happening.
So these missions that are out there right now, are they kind of acting as a reconnaissance for us? Is that the major purpose of these missions, or do some of these missions have specific goals in mind when they're out
there?
Well,
it's a mixture. So some of them are doing a reconnaissance, you know, sort of like a first detailed look at something. So Messenger is really giving us our first, not our absolute first look at Mercury, but our first really close-up and detailed global examination of the planet. We really didn't know Mercury very well until it got there. The Dawn spacecraft that's orbiting the asteroid Vesta, that is a reconnaissance. It's our first look at Vesta in any kind of detail. And the one that's on its way to Pluto will give us our first look at Pluto, which we really know almost nothing about. You know, so there is some reconnaissance. But on the other hand, with spacecraft at the Moon and Mars, we're looking at worlds that we've already examined for several decades. And there, we've got more focused interests. So we're looking at specific things of interest there. There's still a rover functioning on Mars after, you know, 8 years after it landed. It's looking at the rocks, basically going from one kind of rock to another, one place to another. So even though it sounds like it's doing the same thing all the time, it's looking at different rocks.
So we have it's Opportunity, right? That's still alive. We've sent a new rover that's going to go. It launched in November. It's going to get there in August.
Yes.
Is Opportunity going to still run once Curiosity arrives, or do you know anything?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. As long as NASA can actually find enough money to keep it going, Opportunity will go until it breaks down. And actually, it's on exactly on the opposite side of the planet from where the new rover, Mars Science Lab, will land. So they, you know, as Mars rotates, sometimes Opportunity can transmit stuff back to us, and sometimes the new rover can, Curiosity, the new rover. So they chose landing sites that were quite far apart so that they wouldn't interfere with each other. So yeah, the plan is that they will operate at the same time.
So the Curiosity rover that's going to go there now is going to land in, it's Gale Crater, correct?
Gale Crater, that's right.
So
yes.
I know that they had a few places that they were thinking about. Why did they choose Gale Crater specifically?
Well, they did have several places, and every one of them would have been an absolutely fantastic landing site. Every one would have been wonderful. So it didn't really matter from my point of view which one they chose. And all of them had a variety of different kinds of rock. What NASA is really interested in for this is finding old clay rocks on Mars, because clay rocks are produced by the action of water on other kinds of rocky material. They gradually convert the minerals in the rocks to clay. And if that water is sitting around for quite a while doing this little bit of geochemical work on Mars, then that water would also be there potentially to support life. The idea is if we can go to places where we see clay minerals, we're going to places where we know the water was around for a while. And all of these sites had clay. But the thing about Gale, I guess, is that it has so much more. It has multiple layers of rock, different compositions, stacked up one on top of another, basically taking us through a kind of historical story of what's happened at that site over a long period of time. Some of the other sites had that as well, but nothing like as much as Gale. And one of the sites, a place called Morph, only really had one kind of rock in any abundance. So it would have been a much more limited site.
And Curiosity is going to be basically stuck in that crater, is that right? It's not going to be able to get out of there.
No, that's right. But it's a big crater.
Yeah.
It's 100 kilometers across.
Okay.
And there's a lot to see in this crater, so we're not going to want to get out of it, actually.
Okay.
The surroundings wouldn't be anything like as interesting as what is in the crater. And the big thing that is interesting in this crater is this huge stack of layered rocks that rises up like a great mountain in the middle of the crater. Lots of craters have a central mountain, but this is different. This is like if there was an original central mountain in Gale Crater, it's been completely covered by a great big stack of sediments. There will be layer upon layer upon layer of these rocks. So the rover lands off to the side. It can't land on this mountain.
Right.
So it lands in a smooth area off to the side, and it probably take, I don't know how long it will take, let's say it might take 6 months or more, just to drive to the bottom of the hill. But once it gets there, it's got this great big stack of layers going up the hill, and they will explore it, well, as long as they can, as long as they can actually keep going up the hill.
Right.
If they get stuck, then they'll go back down and they'll find another place to go up. So there'll be lots of things to look at there.
And do you know how long they expect Curiosity to be in existence? I know they said Spirit and Opportunity were going to last, what, 90 days or something?
Well, right. I mean, they weren't really saying it would last 90 days, but they designed a 90-day mission, let's say. And then they expected it to last longer. But most people thought that it might last 180 days, you know, half a year. Maybe you could push it up to a year. That would be about it. But they did a fantastic job and they survived for much longer than that. So this new rover, Curiosity, or the Mars Science Lab, it's been specifically designed for an entire Martian year of operations. That's nearly 2 Earth years. So it's going to be, just in the primary mission, it will be a long mission anyway, 2 years. But the chances are it will keep on going after that, again and again and again, year, Mars year after Mars year. I would say it could easily operate for a decade on the surface of Mars.
Okay, very cool. So we'll be looking forward to seeing, first, if it lands safely, correct, in August?
Yes, that's right. And a lot of people are going to be very nervous on landing. But, yeah, that's right.
They call it, what, the 8 minutes of...
Terror,
right?
Yes, that's right. It's really going to be quite dramatic, so we just have to hope for the best. But, you know, the people who've done this, they are very smart, and they've done it before, so right. We just have to hope that they're going to do it again.
And this isn't something that they've done in 6 months. They've been working years and years on this.
Oh, yeah, they've been working a long time on this, yeah.
So you're very familiar with the Mars landscape and the lunar landscape. You have 2 atlases that you have written and published. Can you tell us a little bit about those and what the focus is?
So, yes, I have a book called The International Atlas of Lunar Exploration, which is already out, and we're just working now on the final production of The International Atlas of Mars Exploration, which will be out soon. First, I should say, I guess, they're international because they're covering missions from all over the place. And for the Moon one, that was especially important because we had missions from NASA, from the United States, and also from Russia, the Soviet Union. So I wanted to cover both sides of that. And then a little bit more stuff that was done by the Europeans and the Japanese and so on. So it was international in that sense. And the Mars one is, to be honest, it's mostly American with a little bit of Russian content, but it's still called the International Atlas of Mars Exploration.
Right.
My goal really is to tell the history of exploration for these worlds. So it's historical, but in an atlas format. What I have to do is to go back to each spacecraft mission in turn, and for the Moon, that included a lot of quite early ones, the Rangers and Surveyors, which were robotic spacecraft that preceded the Apollo landings, and then each Apollo landing in turn, then all the Russian ones and so on. And for each mission, I have to go back and find some description of what it did, which isn't difficult to find. But then to find a way to illustrate that in the kind of graphic form that an atlas requires, with lots of maps and annotated photographs.
Right.
And that's where a lot of that work becomes more difficult. As an example, for instance, there were a series of robots called Surveyor that landed before the Apollo landings. The Apollo astronauts land on the Moon, and of course they photograph their surroundings, and those photos are easy to find. They're all over the place. But the Surveyor spacecraft also landed on the Moon and photographed their surroundings. And yet it's been very difficult to find the pictures. You can find the odd one here and there, but the problem is that they were treated as a kind of a poor relation of Apollo. They were just done really to show that the surface was safe to land on and to take a few photos that show the, you know, what the rocks look like on the surface and that kind of thing, how rough the surface is. The pictures were kind of important for Apollo planners, but they never got widely published, and part of the reason is that they're actually not very nice to look at. If you get any individual picture, it's fine.
Right.
But when they tried to fit them together to make a big kind of 360-degree panorama, and bearing in mind that we're doing this in the middle of the 1960s, not now with all our fancy digital equipment and computer software and so on, it was more difficult. If you wanted to make a panorama in those days, you printed off maybe 200 or 300 individual photos, and you laid them all out on the table, and you stuck them together, and then you would photograph that. But what you get is something that looks like fish scales. It's got all these pictures stuck together with visible seams between them. Often the pictures will have a bit of a gradient from light to dark across them, depending on how they're facing relative to the sun. And if all the pictures are like that, then every picture in the panorama has a gradient across it. And it really does look like fish scales. They look horrible. That's really why people hadn't published them very much. So I had to go and find the original data and scan things and put them into Photoshop and so on and clean them up. So my book then had really the first publication of these surveyor panoramas. Most people would never have seen them before, except the people who actually worked on the surveyor missions years ago. Most people just hadn't seen them before. That was months of work. I spent more than a solid year of work just on the surveyor panoramas. This was a lot of work, but it was worth it because it had never been done before. And so that, in a kind of microcosm, is what I'm trying to do for all sorts of things. So let's say with Mars, the Viking spacecraft landed on Mars. They had robot arms that could dig in the soil. They would dig up soil and deliver it to analytical instruments. They would move rocks, try to push a rock out of the way so they could scoop up soil that had been protected underneath the rock. You know, all sorts of things like that. What I wanted to do then was to record every action that the robot arms made on the surface. This, is, again, is something that hadn't been done before. You would, if you go back into the original publications at the time, you might get sort of two or three, let's say, kind of before and after shots of something being done, but not systematically for the whole mission. So I collected all of those things, and I've recorded everything that was done by the Viking spacecraft on the surface of Mars. And again, it hadn't been done before.
So that's very cool. So these atlases, do you think that they're okay for the layman, for example, to pick up and look through, or are they more for people who are studying those bodies in our solar system?
Well, they're designed so that they work for several different audiences, really. So if you're a researcher studying these things, you can go in and look up something and you find it there, and you've got references that take you into the scientific literature, so you can go and find the sources. That's there for researchers. But anybody can pick it up and just look through and look at the pictures and see what was done. And the text is written so that it's accessible to anybody. It's not full of jargon and so on. So it's designed really to suit a lot of different kinds of people.
Like you said, some of the images have never been seen before, so I'm sure that would be really amazing to flip through and look through. There was in the news last week, LRO found some evidence for tectonic activity or something
like
that.
Let's not call it plate tectonics.
Okay.
Tectonics, okay. All right, because there are different kinds of tectonics. Right, so LRO is the Lunar Reconnaissance Orbiter, right? And it's been photographing the moon. And of course, the moon's been photographed before many times, but this spacecraft has a very high resolution camera, beautiful high quality camera that takes very detailed pictures.
So how high is the resolution?
About, you can see things about 50 centimeters across.
Okay.
So if you had a rock about 50 centimeters across, it would just show up as one tiny little dot in the picture, but you could see it.
Right.
Now, we have had very high resolution pictures before, back in the Apollo period, but only for tiny, tiny, very limited areas. What we're getting now is coverage all over the moon at that kind of resolution. So what was reported recently was that in some places on the moon, there were funny little ridges that were kind of being pushed up here and there on the surface of the moon. In other places, there were kind of little cracks in the surface. The ridges suggest places where two adjacent pieces of the moon's crust have been pushed together, and they kind of push up a little ridge between them.
So similar to mountain ranges on
similar, but on a very small scale, have to say. But still, something like that has happened. And then the fractures suggest places where the crust has pulled apart a bit. These are small features, and on the moon, small features tend to get worn away over a period of time. They get eroded away by all the little impact craters that are happening all the time. You get kind of a steady rain of small impacts on the surface of the moon that gradually smooth out features on the lunar surface and cover them up. And if you did get a big impact off to the side at some point, it would throw debris out over the thing you're looking at and cover it up, you know. So small features do get worn away or covered up over a period of time on the moon. And if we can see these rather small ridges and fractures, and then, you know, they're not just small, but they look quite sharp, quite crisp, they haven't been eroded away. Mm-hmm. They must have formed relatively recently. And that kind of goes against the feeling that people had generally had about the moon, that it's been pretty much dead for several billion years. We know that there isn't a lot of activity. The moon isn't making great big new mountain ranges and things like that.
Right.
We know that. But there must be a little bit of activity still happening. And we don't know all the details of it yet because we're only just discovering these features.
So you say these features are relatively new. What does that mean? How many years would that be? Is that 5 years?
Billion? What is relatively new on the moon? Right. And I think the number that was quoted was something like 50 million years. That's even older than me, so it's like it is quite old. But it's not old in planetary terms. Planets are several billion years old, and normally people would kind of think that if something happened more than, say, a billion years ago, you could call it kind of old. But something that's only 50 million years old is pretty recent in lunar terms.
there might be some new theories coming out on why this is happening or why it had happened so recently.
Yeah, and we don't know the answer to that yet. And really, questions like that can only be answered by mapping the distribution of those features. And if we see how they're distributed across the whole surface of the moon, how they, you know, what the orientations are and how they're distributed, if they're concentrated in some areas, maybe if, you know, let's say if they were concentric or radial to some other feature, that kind of thing, some association with other features, that's how you might be able to figure out what's going on. I think they'll need to go on photographing and finding more of them to build up a complete picture of what their distribution is before we can really address that.
Okay, so we'll have to wait a few months or even years to see what they're going to find out. So you, I know you study the surface of the moon, you study the surface of Mars, you're interested in asteroids and mapping those objects. Mm-hmm. So there's quite the debate that goes on in both the planetary science community and in the public about human space exploration, and one, if we should do it, and if we should we go to the moon, should we go to Mars, should we go to asteroids? So what are your thoughts on that subject?
Yes, well, that is a big debate, and you do get a very wide range of opinions about it. It's expensive, of course, and we all know that right now we're living through a period when everybody's short of money and times are difficult for a lot of people. Should we be doing this at all, or should we be scaling back, or if we're going to do it, how do we find the thing that is most, let's say, most cost-effective or most important to do? So there are a lot of issues there. I suppose my feeling first is that space exploration is worth the money. It's not outrageously expensive in comparison with many of the other things that we do. And a lot of people, I think, kind of have a feeling of just vast sums of money being spent on space. It's tiny in proportion to the other big things that are going on in the economy.
One example I often use is that the NASA budget is the same budget they use for air conditioning in Iraq and Afghanistan during those wars. So
it's
tough to put it into perspective because people hear X number of billions of dollars and it's hard for them to imagine if that's small amount or a large amount.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah, that's right. So NASA's budget is only about half of 1% of the US federal budget. And of course, here in Canada, we spend far less than that, but it's still a very small part of our federal budget is space. I think that the expenditures are worthwhile, and I think that if we had to save money, I'd prefer to see it saved somewhere else. But the other issue that comes up here is whether we should be sending people into space or doing things robotically. And I suppose I have kind of mixed feelings about that. I can definitely agree with the argument that robotic spacecraft can do fantastic scientific exploration for very much lower cost than sending people. I can see that. You know, if it was eventually decided that NASA was never going to send people back into space and they were only going to do robotic exploration, I could still be reasonably happy, I guess, because there's still a fantastic amount that could be done with robots. There is something unique, to me, uniquely inspiring and exciting about people. I was privileged, I think, to be a young person, a teenager, during the Apollo landings on the moon, watching live television coverage, if you can believe it, live television coverage of people walking on the moon. It was just incredible.
And isn't it amazing how a generation or two out from there hasn't experienced that?
Yeah, that's right. So a few years ago, it did look as if people were going to go back to the moon when the Constellation program. I had pictures in my mind of people, you know, they'd be at work and they'd take a lunch break and they whip out their phones, their cell phones, and they're watching activities on the moon live on their phone during the lunch break, because the world has changed from the old Apollo days.
Right.
And it would be like that. You'd be able to see things happening all the time. It'd be like having webcams around the lunar base or, you know, the lunar science site that you were studying. And to be honest, people could almost do things like that with Mars these days. You could just check out pictures that were downloaded from Mars just yesterday if you wanted to do that. So we are kind of nearly there with those kinds of things. It's amazing that only old people like me actually saw live lunar exploration by astronauts, and I hope that we will go back to that. And I don't think that it is really outrageously expensive. Obviously, that's a matter of opinion.
In your personal preference, would you prefer to see people going back to the moon, or would you like to see people going somewhere else like Mars or an asteroid or something like that?
Yes. Now, okay, so that's another debate. date. And I have to say, I really believe that anybody who thinks that we can bypass the moon, and certainly bypass the moon and go straight to Mars, I think that is really just a delusion. I'm trying to be polite. Mars is going to be extremely difficult. And by the time we actually get people off the ground in these new spacecraft, there won't be anybody still working. There will hardly be anybody alive who actually knows how to do these things in deep space. So I think we need to actually learn to operate in space again, not just in Earth orbit, but in deep space. We need to relearn these things like lunar surface operations and so on. And also I think a lunar expedition would be a really good rehearsal for what would be done on Mars later on. So I guess, and I know people have talked about going to visit asteroids as well, and I'm certainly in favor of that. But really I would like to see a balanced program that starts with the moon. So I'd like to see what is often these days called stepping stones.
And thinking of the moon as almost a training ground for future missions.
Yeah, that's right. As well as a place that has some fantastic science. We know an awful lot more about the moon now than we did when Apollo was being planned. There are lots of really great places we'd like to send people that are completely different from any Apollo site.
So I think that's probably a great place to end it. So
okay,
thank you very much for being on Western Worlds, and maybe we'll talk to you again in the future.
You're listening to Western Worlds on astronomy.fm. Let's go to the discussion.
So, we all just listened to my interview with Phil Stuck, who's a planetary geologist here at the CPSX. And one of the things he was talking about was the Mars Science Lab mission, which was launched in November, and we'll get to Mars in August, and hopefully we'll land safely. And of course, we have a strong connection to that mission, and maybe Raymond can tell us a little more about that.
Yeah, actually, we have a group here at Western led by John Moores, who we heard at the start of the show, of course, to do atmospheric studies using some of the instruments on the MSL rover. And we're looking at tracking the position and presence of fog and ice particles that may be in the atmosphere at the location of the robot, and also trying to do autonomous tracking of the clouds in the atmosphere in photographs so that we can calculate wind speeds. And so my role actually is to develop that cloud tracking algorithm. But John will be leading Western's contribution to the project.
What will we learn by studying the cloud movements?
Yeah, so of course, trying to understand the winds on Mars is difficult because in the atmosphere being more or less transparent, you can't see it without some kind of telltale. Now, there are ways of detecting wind if you have some kind of in-situ sounding instrument, but we don't have that. All we have is cameras. And so what we're going to use is the movement of the clouds as a proxy for understanding the winds. And if we know the winds, then we can study the global dynamics of the atmosphere, we can understand a bit better the climate, and also it gives us some hints as to the movement and transportation of mass and water to the extent that this is happening in the Martian atmosphere. And that has further implications for whether signs of past life that may have existed on the planet, biomarkers, might be preserved. And so there's a lot that we can infer and can take if we have a better understanding of how the atmosphere works. And that starts just from knowing what the wind is. Almost everything that happens in looking at the surface of a planet starts from simple basic measurements like that. Everything you do in meteorology and climatology starts with temperatures and wind measurements and humidity and pressure. You build everything else from there.
So when we have these other missions, Phil mentioned quite a few of them around Mercury and Saturn and Jupiter and Pluto. All of those missions kind of have the similar type of goals in mind.
Well, most of them are looking from orbit, right? So most of them, I guess, are just mapping, but I expect there's still quite a lot of interesting information.
Yeah, also measuring the magnetic fields of planets like Saturn and Jupiter, which obviously have a way stronger magnetic fields, which can also infer a lot about the interiors of the planets. Orbiters like that can be really helpful to actually understand the interiors of those planets, which we actually cannot see other than Earth. We cannot infer the interior of the planets or the moons other than just tracking the magnetic fields.
And of course, a surface mission like MSL will give you very detailed and very high resolution information about the place where that mission is sitting. But an orbiting mission can give you much broader data sets, perhaps even global.
Yes, in the interview we heard all about mapping the entire moon to figure out about the tectonics going on.
And in fact, you know, Phil suggests, he hints at the importance of these sort of mapping exercises to give you the big picture, the global picture.
Yeah.
Because it's planetary science. It's not just geology, just looking at a particular rock, but understanding the planet at a global scale, or the planets in general.
Also, such orbiters can be really helpful to understand the dynamics around giant planets and their moon system, which can be really helpful to infer different dynamics between our moon and our Earth, comparing our system to the giant system as well.
Yeah, he mentioned the Cassini mission, which has taken some incredible pictures of Saturn and all of Saturn's moons. Are they awesome pictures coming out almost daily or weekly from that mission?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
It's almost an embarrassment of riches. One person can't keep up with the torrent of information. Back in the old days when there was Galileo, you could... And that was the only probe
out
there.
One guy with a telescope, yeah.
Well, I mean the Galileo space probe.
in the not quite old days.
I mean, within my memory,
right?
Back when there was only one or two probes in the solar system, every finding was a big deal. Splash on the headlines, right? And now it's an embarrassment of wonders. So we have mapped Mercury for the first time ever. We're just completing the full survey of the entire planet, and they're spiraling inwards to get a higher resolution map. Now, that planet has been known since antiquity.
Mm-hmm.
So it's one of the naked eye planets. It's only now in the 21st century that we've mapped the entire thing, which is really impressive.
And how much of the public is really aware that we've
That's another thing, right? I mean, we've got multitudes of missions out there, and how many of these does the public know about? They probably heard of Spirit and Opportunity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
They may have heard of the new Mars Science Lab that's going up. Maybe they've heard of Cassini. But we have all these other missions, like Messenger, LRO,
Dawn,
New Horizons. And how many of these do the public really know about?
But I bet if you had one mission, you have 20 of these robotic missions happening. If you had one mission with astronauds...
Going
to the moon.
Everyone would pay attention. As he said, if you could just watch the footage live on your phone or whatever, how could you not watch astronauts walking around the surface of Mars?
And how sad is it that the last time that something like that happened was...
In
the
60s.
We've never seen
generation.
It.
Yeah.
Right. But even then, it got old really quick. If you look at the ratings, nobody watched the launch of Apollo 13. No one cared. It was done in 11 and 12. We saw it. Okay, great. And then it blew up and everyone's, now this is interesting.
The first time is a novelty and things do trail off. People thought about the space shuttle as this thing that was routine, right? And then it blew up. But it is interesting that, novelty sells. Whether the public is fully aware of it or not, and whether things like this radio show helped that, we have missions around almost every planet right now, traveling to a bunch of the minor bodies. And so there really is an exciting time in planetary exploration where robotics is enabling us to see the solar system from every angle. The question of whether we can also do this with human exploration is sort of still on the drawing board, I guess.
It's more the question if we want to pay for it.
Yeah, which is a point, actually, that Phil brings up, is what about the cost?
Yeah, the robotics is fairly cost-effective, but for people, you need to send them a lot more stuff. You need to send food, water, air, just to keep them alive.
But, of course, MSL is already a $2 billion mission, right?
Yeah.
And
compared to some other things in some budgets, that might not be a lot.
It's an interesting question whether is it even an either-or to do robotics and human exploration? Mm-hmm. And is it an even either-or to do space and other things? As Alyssa mentioned during the interview, NASA's budget is tiny compared to the U.S. government budget. And in general, countries with space programs spend a very small fraction of their budget on space. Canadian Space Agency, $300 to $400 million out of a $200 billion budget. We're not throwing a huge amount of cash at this as a fraction of expenditure anyway.
And the cash we are throwing at it still goes to jobs and technology and development and research and all sorts of stuff that's still valuable, even if we didn't launch some of it out into space.
Yeah, that's the argument. People say, why don't you spend the money on Earth? Well, we aren't stacking $100 bills in the rocket. Every dollar spent on space exploration gets handed to somebody. Not me, usually, but a highly skilled worker. So not me. And then circulated through the economy.
Yeah, it's interesting that, there have been a lot of efforts to do robotic exploration in particular. NASA and the European Agency have both set up these sort of competitive programs for choosing coming missions at different price points. They have, they have different nomenclature for it on either side of the ocean, but they have their relatively cheap ones of a couple tens of million, and then they're more expensive, and then they have their so-called flagship missions that cost $1 billion or more.
Has anyone gotten to see one of the atlases?
Yeah, we have seen his atlases, and they're obviously beautiful. Just like when you look at Earth from ISS, it's a view of the spacecraft from its orbit to the Mars, and you can see at least 50 centimeters resolution, which is
incredible.
Compared to what we had before.
Well, it's actually better than what's publicly available for Earth. You have better scans of Mars than you can get with Google Earth.
One of the things I think is interesting is that, Phil has, in publishing those atlases, he's had to go to this effort of reconstructing the timeline of these missions and which instrument was used where and what disruption was made to the soil. And he's doing this very detailed history of something that only happened in, 4 square meters.
right? This like incredibly detailed geography of a tiny space.
Mm-hmm.
Because of course a lot happened, and mm-hmm. everything that ever happened on Mars before about 2000 happened at the Viking landing sites. But it's interesting that there is that much effort to do, and that actually that story has not been written down before Phil prepared these atlases.
A lot of old information put mm-hmm. away in dusty drawers and maybe not kept track of.
You know, he's talking about how difficult it was for him to get the documentation and the images.
Yeah.
For example, for these robots that went to the moon, no one bothered to systematically record that. So how important is documentation to the future of exploration? Arguably, very.
Yeah. We spend all this money to learn these things. We better keep track of the things we learn. Yeah, it's all interesting. It's all beautiful pictures. So.
Coming from the astrophysics perspective, that reminds me of what we call the Pioneer Anomaly. Mm-hmm. Pioneer's probe launched in the early 70s out to Jupiter and points further on, and it seemed like it was going too fast. It was this anomalous acceleration, and no one could figure out, and that there's been physicists coming up with crazy theories that yeah. modify the law of gravity or
mm-hmm.
throw out everything we know just to explain the fact that the spacecraft's going a little bit too fast. Well, what they were able to do is, because no one threw out the original data tapes, they were able to find the original data tapes moldering under a staircase, in fact, just before they were thrown out. So, luck of the draw there. And then, there's only one in the world recorder that can read these tapes, which NASA had just recently sent to landfill. They literally had to pull it out and rebuild it.
Wipe it off.
wipe off the other garbage, rebuild it, read all these tapes in. And this turned into like a 10-year project. But after they read in all the tapes, they found out, okay, turns out it's going pretty much as fast as it's supposed to be, given all the history of the object. But we would never have figured that out if we didn't know exactly every course correction. Every time we turned the spacecraft, it might have given it a little more speed in one direction or other.
Now, yeah. Do you think that was somebody, some poor grad student's PhD thesis?
I expect so, yeah.
All these tapes would be like...
And the funny thing, of course...
Chapter one, the landfill.
That's right. And the funny thing, of course, is that a lot of these famous space missions, the Viking and the Apollo, all of these things, these all happened, or at least began, in a day when we were doing pure analog recording of things coming off the radio on magnetic tapes.
Yeah, there was no real computer.
Yeah, and nowadays it's much easier to track data.
Right.
It's much easier, you know, in fact, the space probe generates so much imagery that they can't even send it all back. And we can very easily record all of that stuff. The question is whether it's going to be recorded in a way that's easy to search and easy to understand later for the people
file
who are...
types change over
that's right.
10, yeah. 20 years. Yeah. You might not be able to read or...
Exactly.
Like,
you know, here they are back in those days when going through those tapes was that difficult. You know, so hopefully we won't have as many problems with that in the future.
I think we might have learned our lesson.
Mm-hmm.
I hope anyway.
That's our show for this week. Western Worlds is a co-production of the Center for Planetary Science and Exploration and Astronomy.fm. This episode was produced by Alyssa Gilbert and Michael Forster and featured an interview by co-host Alyssa Gilbert. Our roundtable discussion featured co-hosts Tyler August, Raymond Francis, David Kirsch, Harshati Patel, and Alyssa Gilbert. Our editors were Alyssa Gilbert, John Moores, and Michael Forster. And, as always, I'm Dr. John. You can continue the conversation online or learn more about Western Worlds by visiting our website, cpsx.uwo.ca/westernworlds. You can also email us at westernworlds@uwo.ca. On Twitter, we are at WWAFM, and on Facebook, we are Western-Worlds. On behalf of everyone here at Western Worlds, I'd like to thank you for joining us tonight. I hope that you can make world enough and time for Western Worlds again next week, right here on astronomy.fm.